welcome to Skagit Talks. Interviews with interesting people from Skagit Valley College, as well as folks from around the Skagit Valley. Now, Skagit Talks. Welcome to Skagit Talks. In the first half of our program, KSVR presents the Skagit Valley News from around the Skagit Valley, as reported by Joanna Bruno. The second half of Skagit Talks will be our interview from the community and Skagit Valley College. Now, KSVR, Skagit Valley's community radio, presents the news.
The state of Washington has 655 fewer people in prison than it did a year ago. In fact, half of the states have lower prison populations today, according to a new report from Pew Center on the States. Part of the reason is the expense of keeping people locked up, which has prompted many states to consider alternatives. For Washington, anyone who enters the corrections system gets a risk assessment of their likelihood to reoffend. Linnell Nussbaum with the State Sentencing Guidelines Commission says judges also have more leeway in sentencing drug and nonviolent offenders.
The cost of corrections is one of the highest budget costs in this state. We are spending a great deal of money for an illusion of making us all safer, and there are smarter ways to do that at a lower cost.
The Pew report shows Washington's prison population decreased 3.7% in 2009. A total of about 17,000 people are currently incarcerated. The Department of Corrections expects the state to face a shortage of prison beds by 2017, in part because of prison closures. This year's budget crisis prompted plans to close three state prisons and move some inmates to other facilities. Nussbaum says lawmakers also propose amendments to the sentencing laws every year.
For many years, the state has operated on getting tough on crime, and in the recent years, it has worked very hard to try instead to be smart on crime. We've looked at what actually works in reducing prison populations without reducing public safety.
If you're a regular listener of this program, you may recall that last fall we reported on the draft Wolf Plan for Washington State. Now, scientists who have reviewed the draft of Washington's Wolf Conservation and Management Plan have a disagreement over the numbers. According to the scientists, the population recommendations in the draft plan aren't biologically defensible and will not ensure the reestablishment of a self-sustaining population of gray wolves in Washington. According to David Graves with the National Parks Conservation Association, the plan sets a goal for 15 breeding pairs, while the scientists say somewhere between 300 and 600 wolves would be needed to ensure a healthy population. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife released the scientific review of the plan.
You're not going to please everybody, but at least a science-based plan will have goals that are clear and based on some fact rather than just opinion or compromise or political dealings. That's something that is objective.
Some ranchers expressed concerns at recent public meetings that more wolves will endanger their livestock. Graves says the plan calls for compensation of any losses suffered by livestock producers.
There are definitely strong feelings across the spectrum. Some people that I encountered at those meetings feel any wolf is a bad wolf and that they're a menace to society and should not be allowed back in the state.
Graves says there is still room for debate about the exact number with such a difference between the scientific opinion and the state plan.
Now, we're not saying that Washington definitely needs 500 wolves, but 15 breeding pairs could result in as few as 97 wolves, and that obviously is not enough to maintain a viable population.
The Washington legislature has pledged to do a better job of helping future voters by taking a closer look at early childhood education and providing more money for it when the state's financial condition improves. One of two bills on the governor's desk guarantees funding at no less than current levels for the program known as ECAP that serves 3- and 4-year-olds from low-income families. Representative Roger Goodman of Kirkland says he got some criticism for for a bill that promises to spend state money, but fellow lawmakers ultimately decided starting kids off early on the path to learning is a smart investment.
This is just good for our tax dollar. It's the best return to make sure the kids are ready for kindergarten. If you're not ready for kindergarten, it's rare that they catch up entirely. And we want to make sure kids graduate and keep kids out of trouble and prepare children for, a good job later.
The state-funded ECAP program has a waiting list of more than 3,000 children. Senator Claudia Kaufman's bill is also awaiting the governor's signature. Her proposal creates a work group to analyze every type of early learning program now available in the state with the goal of making recommendations for quality and funding.
They all have different requirements. They all have different expectations. And so I really wanted to look at what's going on in all these different areas and come up with a comprehensive plan.
Hannah Lidman with the Economic Opportunity Institute says both bills offer some hope for working parents. Right now, state-funded preschool programs are full, and yet they serve only about one-fourth of the kids who qualify for them.
When you fold in the federal government's Head Start program, you add another 25-30%, but then we're only serving up to 60-some percent of the lowest-income children in this state, and more than those children need access to quality care.
A national survey may provide the answer to the question of why so many consumers are moving their money from too-big-to-fail banks to not-for-profit financial cooperatives. Because credit unions are the most trusted financial institutions in America, and banks are the least trusted. Customers of the biggest banks in the United States are the least likely to believe their financial institution does what's best for them, as opposed to what's best for the bottom line, according to Forrester's Research Incorporated, an independent research company which has conducted this analysis for more than a decade. It ranks nearly 50 financial services firms in the United States based on responses from each firm's customers. A full 70% of credit union members surveyed agreed with the statement, "My financial provider does what's best for me, not just its own bottom line," according to Forrester's annual Customers Advocacy Rankings. The high customer advocacy ranking, according to the report's authors, means that members believe their credit union takes their side in disputes, does what is right, even if it's not required by regulation to do so, gives fair rates or performance comparisons, and is clear about charges and fees. Washington Credit Union League President and CEO John Analoro says the high member rating is due to credit unions' cooperative, member-owned business model, which allows them to place member service ahead of the bottom line. Credit unions have operated in Washington State as fully chartered, regulated, and federally insured depository institutions since 1933. Credit unions were not the cause of the national or global banking crisis, said Analoro. Accordingly, many consumers are reconsidering their financial institution relationships. There are now credit union accounts held in nearly 40% of all Washington State households. The results are based on a survey of about 4,500 consumers. Concentrations of pesticides found in salmon-bearing waters in 5 Washington state watersheds are low and generally below levels of concern for most pesticides, according to just-released reports from the State Departments of Ecology and Agriculture. The report's authors concluded that pesticide concentrations found between 2006 and 2008 are not expected to directly affect salmon. However, pesticide concentrations found at some sites may harm aquatic invertebrate populations that serve as a food source for salmon. Since 2003, the Joint Agency Program has collected weekly samples from salmon-bearing waters in Washington that represent both agricultural and urban landscapes. The program is one of the most intensive pesticide monitoring efforts for surface waters in the country. This pesticide monitoring project provides policymakers with a valuable tool to inform their decision-making, said Washington State Department of Agriculture Director Dan Newhouse. Federal or state agencies and lawmakers need accurate data about the low levels of pesticides present in the waters of our state as they evaluate the effectiveness of our current regulations and laws. Rob Duff, manager of Ecology's Environmental Assessment Program, said this news is encouraging. However, we need to consider the combined efforts from multiple pesticides and other stressors such as high stream temperatures and low dissolved oxygen. The new report contains results from surface water samples the program collected from 2006 to 2008. The state collected water samples from Thornton Creek in Seattle, the Skagit Delta, the Lower Yakima Valley, and from the Wenatchee and Entiat basins. During the three-year period, the state analyzed 1,194 samples for more than 160 pesticides and pesticide breakdown products. Analysis detected 74 pesticides or breakdown products, with nearly all present at concentrations so low that they did not violate state or federal water quality standards. Periodically, the program detected 6 currently registered insecticides: permethrin, pyrifos, diazinon, azofos, methyl, melathion, and endosulfan at levels that do not meet state or federal water quality standards. The program also detected levels of DDT that do not meet water quality standards. DDT persists in the environment even though it has not been registered for use in the United States since 1972. WSDA continues to work with pesticide applicators to identify steps to reduce pesticide exposure in salmon habitat, including use of application techniques that reduce potential transport of pesticides to water. The agency plans for future monitoring efforts to evaluate the success of such strategies and determine if further action is needed. The report is called Surface Water Monitoring Program for Pesticides in Salmonid-Bearing Streams 2006-2008 Triennial Report, a cooperative study by the Washington State Departments of Ecology and Agriculture. And you can read the report by visiting the WSDA website or Ecology website. Washington State Attorney General Rob McKenna congratulated Congress for approving the Prevent All Cigarette Trafficking, or PACT, Act. The new law combats the multi-million dollar internet cigarette trade by restricting the mailing of tobacco products. For years, state attorneys general have worked to stop tobacco traffickers from evading state laws, flooding the market with artificially cheap cigarettes, McKenna said. Cheap tobacco drives up smoking rates and enables tobacco tax avoidance. Our thanks go to Congress and the President for supporting the PACT Act. The PACT Act ramps up penalties for renegade businesses that use the U.S. Post Office to illegally deliver tobacco products. McKenna, the Tobacco Committee co-chair for the National Association of Attorneys General, championed the measure by recruiting his fellow attorneys generals to lobby for the passage of the bill. The Washington State Attorney General's Office won passage of similar state legislation in 2009. Senate Bill 5340 prohibits the shipment of tobacco products purchased through the internet or by mail to anyone other than licensed wholesalers or retailers. State attorney generals and federal officials have kept an eye on interstate cigarette trafficking because it undercuts the public health principles of the landmark 1998 settlement with major tobacco companies, the Master Settlement Agreement, designed to lower tobacco use. 6 days after receiving unanimous Senate approval, the U.S. House of Representatives gave final approval in a 387-25 vote and sent the bill to President Obama for his signature. Once enacted, the legislation will curb the estimated $223 million in tax revenue lost by Washington State each year. Cigarette trafficking will also be elevated from a misdemeanor offense to a felony crime. Attorney General Rob McKenna announced recently that Washington will receive nearly $100,000 to be split between the state's general fund and Medicaid program from a national settlement with drug maker Al Pharma. Washington joined other states and the federal government to reach an agreement with Al Pharma Incorporated, settling allegations that the company made false or fraudulent claims about Cadian, a morphine-based pain medication. Taxpayers pay for drugs when they are prescribed to Medicaid recipients, McKenna said. We should be sure that the drugs work as advertised. While most drug companies provide honest information about effective products, we aggressively pursue the ones who make inflated claims. It's about protecting the public's investment in these programs. This is Joanna Bruno for KSVR News for Skagit Valley. Thanks for listening to 91.7 FM. Please stay tuned for another Skagit Talks interview.
Hello, I'm Rip Robbins. Today's group of guests on Skagit Talks are led by Mr. Jerry LaFollette, an instructor in the Human Services Program at Skagit Valley College. Joining him today are students from the Human Services 149 class, the Social Problems course. And they're here today to talk about one of the research projects in the class this quarter, something that affects people close to home. And that is a question about whether the American family is in decline. And to talk about the perceptions of that question, we have three students here. There's John Horn, Jacob Dodds, and Sean Arizmendi. So to all of you, welcome to Skagit Talks in KSVR.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry? Could you start by giving our audience an overview of the class project this quarter?
Thank you, Rip. This class is called Social Problems, and we look at a variety of different problems that are affecting the contemporary American community. We look at crime and delinquency. We look at issues related to drug abuse. And we also have the students have selected one of the topics that they were interested in to be looking at the American family. Over time, the family has changed in many ways. We have some people saying the American family is in crisis now. So that, in a sense, is the problem that this group of students has been studying over the last few weeks and are prepared to talk a little bit about and share their ideas with members of your audience.
Well, great. Thanks. So let's go to our students here. Let's start with John Horn. How did you characterize this topic, and what did you consider when you were formulating a position on this question?
The view that I looked at is the things that I found. It's asking if it's a national crisis or not. And I read a lot of facts on how the traditional family, where the mother stays at home and the father works and provides for the family, that's how it used to be back in the 50s and 60s. And since then, it has declined, as people say, that now I think it has a lot to do with the economy and the more of the social evolution of America and the fact that it's almost impossible now to run an entire household in only one income. You need a dual income to at least get by.
So what you found is there was an economic factor to the change of the American family.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's move to Jacob. And Jacob, again, the same question. How did you characterize the topic and what did you consider?
Well, when I was first given the topic, I decided to study the different viewpoints of it. I researched the aspects of the more conservative base, those that feel that America's families itself are on a decline and that their main answer is to revert to a simpler time or simpler structure. And then I also looked at the more liberal side, who state that change is a necessity to natural evolution, and that America as a society needs to adapt as well as the rest of the world. And one of its biggest constraints is that many people want to put their feet in the mud and not accept the fact that change is inevitable. And they're both debates did reveal a few key aspects and few key points, which I feel have merit in their own way.
Okay, and we'll hear some more about those in just a minute. Sean, I want to get to your answer to the same question. How did you characterize the topic, and what did you consider when you were looking at a position?
I looked at mostly like back in the days, like in the 1950s, where it was the mom that stayed at home, and seeing like how it changed through the years. I have a teenager and have kids of my own and married, so I sort of look at that on a continuous basis all the time just to see what works for other families and what works for mine and see what's beneficial and, you know, what's not. And just did a little research, you know, on those and just seeing, like, how family dinners make a big difference and see, you know, the downfall of both working parents and what the benefits are, too, at the same time. So I just looked at a lot of just aspects that hit home in some aspects. So.
Well, and what I'm hearing is that you're looking at the roles of the parents in the home. It seems that all three of you have talked about the role of two parents, one being a worker and one staying at home, that seems to be central to the discussion. And are there any other aspects to this besides that the women have had to go to work? You'd brought up the economics. With you, there's kind of a position on that. And with you, you're looking at how it works with your own family. So I see, Jacob, you have some other.
One other aspect that was pointed out by both sides is the increased addiction that Americans have towards technology and the influence that will have on today's youth. The majority of parents rely on items like, say, television or the internet to act as babysitters, mentors, and teachers to their children when they are out because of work or other obligations, and the possible dangers that having technology in those roles can present to children. Technology has no moral compass, no set of value systems, and so what a child learns from those can give them a crooked view of the world and could lead to very dangerous lessons.
As a follow-up, Jacob, do you think that parents have relied on technology because of the strains on their own schedules?
From what I've gathered and from what I know from personal experience, it does appear so. It doesn't mean that parents no longer care about their family values, but because of the pressures that affect their lives, they require some level of assistance, in which case technology can abide by that in time. Technology isn't mad, but it's good in moderation.
John, you mentioned economics. Is there we're in the richest country in the world still. So how is it that the family unit is so disrupted by economics to where both parents need to work and aren't at home? Did you find anything out about that, or what's your view on that?
It's just mainly the cost of living now is so high that one person working does not make a high enough wage to cover mortgage and bills and take care of family. So then the mother has to step out and become a dual-income family. As much as things have increased and the cost of living has risen over the years, the wage has not risen equally proportionate to that. So it's you make a lot more now than you did then, but you also have to pay considerably more. And you just can't – ends can't meet that way.
Well, Sean, when you're looking at your own family, do you see that it's economics, or is it that the members of the family are no longer seem to be operating as a family unit?
I think it has to do with both. And when I look at my family, like John said about the economics, is, you know, I moved from California to here to be able to have that, what you would say, a traditional family. The mom stays at home, the husband goes to work. And we were only able to do that moving out here with the way the economy is out here, although it's still high. It's not as high as other states. So it's still able to give us that that being able to be at home, watching the kids, having somewhat of the traditional lifestyle. And I think in other places it's really hard. Financially, it's really hard to be at home and have one parent at home. With Jacob, I think it is a lot of the technology that is watching the kids, not on purpose, but more so just that's the times it has to be two parents. It's really financially hard. So I think it has to combine all together.
And Jacob, you mentioned kind of a philosophical divide, they're conservative and liberal. But let me say that in some of the westernized countries like Europe, they probably have a similar situation to ours with two members of the two parents working and so forth. Does it look to you in this that it's kind of just a natural progression in a nation that's advancing in their economic wealth that this kind of circumstance comes to be, or is it really something else?
I think it's I'd have to say it is kind of a traditionalist value. When you consider the world that you see every day and the children live in, and you try and close your eyes and picture the kind of life that you lived in your time, you might consider it to be more simple, safe, more role that should be. And if you are in a wealthy nation, be it the United States or be it any other area, and you are being told constantly that change is a necessity, you might find it resistant because the change itself that you are seeing is only causing more and more problems. Say, for example, for the United States example, when women were allowed more in the workforce, of course, it is right because that's the level of equality, which is a sign of evolution. It also has increased to an amount where single parents and divorcees have increased in the United States as well, which have resulted in a massive amount of statistics saying that children suffer as a result of it. So from a conservative standpoint, they would go towards revoking that and going back to the 1940s model. A more liberal viewpoint would be more towards the seeing it through the end. Change is difficult, but change can lead to brighter and better things as time goes on. I'm not quite sure if I answered your question specifically.
Well, you brought up some good points for our audience to consider in that. So, John, when we're looking at this, kind of the same question that I have is it a natural set of circumstances that evolve when a nation becomes more wealthy? What would you think would be a resolution to this problem?
Personally, with myself, I think of a resolution as a solution to a problem, and I don't see it as a problem, that it's a natural evolution of society. What hasn't changed between 1920 and now? It's just an ongoing thing, and people learn how to work the different systems of family, and people live differently. And I don't really see it as an issue that needs to be solved. It's just something to notice.
So, Jacob, you've pointed out that there's people that may want to go back to a kind of a social structure that we had in decades past. How would you see that being implemented in our society today?
To be honest, there I've tried to consider it, and it would be dangerous for the most part. When a person looks back in the past and remembers the good, they very rarely consider the negative aspects of it or the situation or how going back would affect other groups so far. To be honest, when I look around at the world I'm in, the job I'm in, the family I have, I mean, it's not perfect, but I'd rather have the family and the job and the life here than it was way back when things were a lot more restricted and a lot more difficult to get ahead.
That's good. Sean, how do you keep optimism with your family given the economic problems that we face today, and how do you see things improving?
Mine is just maintaining family values, and that's just spending time with your kids, eating dinner with them, making sure that there's restrictions as far as computer time, video time, even texting time. I mean, it's a huge ordeal in our home, and just to maintain those family values that we eat together every night, we go over homework together every night, and I think the only way that I don't know that it needs to be improved. I think a big thing that is in the traditional family that we've seen, or that I've seen when doing this project, is that a lot of it is everybody wants something more and more and more and more. Find, just the nicer car, the nicer home, and this. And it's not always what makes the family happy and productive. And I think that's the only thing that I would say maybe needs to change. Maybe just...
Wow. Well, what a topic. And thanks to you all for coming in today to talk about it. Today on Skagit Talks, we've had a group here from Skagit Valley College from the Human Services 149 class, a social problems course. We heard from John Horn, Jacob Dodds, and Sean Arizmendi. And they were led by Mr. Jerry LaFollette, the instructor in the Human Services program. Thanks to all of you for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you,
Rip.
I'm Rip Robbins. Thanks for listening.
Skagit Talks was produced by Joseph C. McGuire and engineered by Jay Charles. Tune in next time for more Skagit Talks.